to Big Nerdy Questions, or welcome for the first time. We would like to welcome all of our listeners tonight for a special crossover event. We are super honored to welcome Steven from the Beltway Banthas podcast. Welcome, Steven, to Big Nerdy Questions.
Hey, it's a real pleasure to be joining you on the BNQ. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And of course, with a podcast like Beltway Banthas, which we'll talk about in a second, you know our topic tonight is our beloved Star Wars. And I've got the entire Star Wars expert panel lined up tonight. We've got Ed.
Hello, everyone. How are you?
We've got Colleen.
I've got my Star Wars pants on. Let's do this.
And we've got the man that kills the Gungan. We've got Matt.
Jar Jar's getting it from all sides tonight.
Excuse me, what is he wearing? I'm kidding.
I really do have Star Wars pants on, by the way.
I didn't doubt you, actually.
I know. Kylo Ren themed.
Nice.
I've got my Kylo Ren mug here keeping me company.
I've got my Star Trek shirt on, but you guys knew that would happen.
No! Dude, come on.
I'm not wearing any sci-fi themed clothing, but there is a C-3PO themed Windows controller on my desk next to the 3D model of R2-D2 that Colleen gave me.
And I'm the only one with Star Wars ink on my arm, so I'll stick with that.
Okay, you win, sir. Well done. So tonight's question. Steven is an expert in politics and in Star Wars, so we decided to bring the two together for this episode, as is appropriate for Beltway Banthas. Tonight's topic is, was the Galactic Empire doomed to fail? We'll get into our specifics of what we mean by that in just a minute, but first, we have a big nerdy recommendation, and tonight that comes from Ed. Ed, what's our recommendation?
It's oddly appropriate. I am recommending Star Wars Catalyst, a Rogue One novel by James Luceno. It is a tie-in novel to the upcoming film, Rogue One, and it details a couple of the main characters, Galen Erso, who is Jen's father, Orson Krennic, who's the big bad guy, and how Galen was kind of conscripted into knowingly/unknowingly working with the government, and his work being used in creation of the Death Star. He was not aware of that part.
We'll have to check
and
that
might
out.
And might I add, just real quick, it was a fantastic read. I mean, it was just my favorite Star Wars book added to canon here in recent years.
It was really good. I really enjoyed it.
A weak moment.
That's incredible. We have a double recommendation from Ed and Steven. So everyone, check out Catalyst. Matt, I believe you brought us a sponsor.
That's right, Josh. Tonight's episode is brought to us by Rogue Game. Take out TIE fighters without needing those pesky midichlorians with Rogue Game.
Oh my
now
God.
Available in blue milk flavor.
Oh, man. That might have been your best one yet.
I get the feeling that these are not real sponsors, guys.
Well, we do have one real sponsor, actually, and our sponsor is Dragon Fruit. The dating app made for geeks by geeks. We've had Ori on the show a few weeks ago on Star Wars. If you are looking for that special someone to snuggle up with you while you're frozen in carbonite, check out dragonfruitapp.com or search Dragonfruit in the Apple Store or in the Google Play Store.
Is it bad that I only thought of Jabba? Jabba seems to have a fetish for people in carbonite, just saying.
Oh.
It's true.
I find Jabba to be a very rancorous lover.
There you go. The Rogue Game was bad.
There he goes again.
So, Steven, from Beltway Banthas, can you tell us a little bit about this most illustrious show?
Yeah, so Beltway Banthas is a Star Wars and politics podcast about where the two intersect. It was really originally inspired by some talk about Star Wars during the Republican primary in 2015. There was all this chatter when Marco Rubio epically smacked down Jeb Bush in the middle of a debate that the apprentice had finally overthrown the master, and this was being talked about in the news a bunch. And the wheel started turning in my head. I was like, you know what? We talk about this all the time. Like, politics, people in politics are always referencing Star Wars to explain good and evil, light and dark, right and wrong. It's just sort of part of communication. I remember when I was a kid, I saw Newt Gingrich and Nancy Pelosi both do a crossover History Channel special on Star Wars. So I thought, you know what? This is a better year than any. With all of the Star Wars we have going on right now and it being an election year, to start actually addressing this crossover, because I've gotten into Star Wars podcasts, and this is an issue that people are, I think, rightfully afraid to touch. It's volatile. It can get mean. The comments section of any forum can get pretty dark pretty quick, as soon as you start talking about what you think the politics of Star Wars are. So we intrepidly embrace this idea that it should be talked about, and we have a lot of fun doing it. And surprisingly, I've not gotten any hate mail yet.
And I assume our listeners can find you on the typical channels, iTunes, Google, etc.
Absolutely, yeah. You can find us on Twitter, always chattering, at Beltway Banthas. We are part of the RetroZap podcast network, so if you go to RetroZap.com, you can find us there, or just on BeltwayBanthas.com is our main website where we just host a lot of the audio. The show is on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, all of that. So
perfect.
Readily accessible.
And, so when it came to topics, they said to you, don't touch the third rail, and you walked up and just licked it.
I just laid on it, yeah, just laid on it. It's about the only thing I enjoy talking about is politics and Star Wars, and really, just merging them together makes me a happy person, so.
Well, it makes sense, and, you know, a couple of us on the show all have history training, so we've done our fair share of history crossovers, and I think it's a natural fit. So tonight's topic is, was the Galactic Empire doomed to fail? And I bring this topic to the Big Nerdy Questions panel from the historical and political point of view. As we all know from the original trilogy, by the end of Return of the Jedi, the Galactic Empire has been defeated, although the extent to which they've been defeated is up for debate, and I feel like one of our panelists, at least, will be talking about that in a little while. But the question remains, were they defeated solely because the rebellion was a successful force? Or were they defeated because of factors that were inherent to their internal structure? If you look at historical parallels to the empire, such as the Roman Empire in the case of the Visigoths, or more recently and perhaps more presciently the Soviet Union, you could make a case that there are internal flaws in play with a giant empire that focuses only on infrastructural things like giant megaprojects and not on proper resource allocation. In the case of the Soviet Union, we actually had one of our most famed political scientists and diplomats, George Kennan, write an article in Foreign Affairs in the 1950s where he argued for containment to defeat the Soviet Union because he said the inherent flaws in the communist system, and especially the way it was administered by Stalin and then by Khrushchev, would lead to the Soviet Union collapsing under its own weight. And sure enough, once Gorbachev relaxed a few regulations, in addition to the pressure brought on by Ronald Reagan and the United States, it did just that. But the question still remains for historians. It was Kennan right, or was it only going to end at that moment because of the pressures from Reagan? We have a similar parallel here. Was the empire only doomed to fail because of who it was facing? The Force, Luke Skywalker, a very well-organized guerrilla force? Or was it going to fail no matter what, and the rebellion was simply the agent by which the inevitable change occurred? It's an interesting topic, and I open the floor up first to our special guest, Stephen. Since you are our political aficionado, what are your thoughts first when we talk about the demise of the empire?
Well, I think you have to preface it first by admitting that there is no right answer to this question. There are definitely a lot of different scenarios in which the empire could have lasted, and a lot of different factors that brought the empire down. Now, looking at what we have just specifically with the movies, what you have is an insurgent rebellion who makes strategic strikes right at the right points. I mean, they basically only get big wins. We see a lot of the small wins that they're achieving, you know, via Star Wars Rebels, TV shows, books, but we're basically seeing them wipe out the major battle station of Empire two times within three movies, and those are decisive blows each time. It's wiping out their higher command in Episode 4, and then in Episode 6, they are wiping out really the entire hierarchy of the Empire, from the Emperor to his royal court, all of his advisors, Darth Vader, everybody. They're all gone. So I think what you have here is that these strategic strikes expose one of the main flaws in the Empire, which is that it is not built to last. It is built only so much as Palpatine can be in charge of it. And I think as a guy who entered the Star Wars saga chronologically, as someone who wanted to overpower death and find a way to conquer death, I don't think he ever really saw himself not being in charge of the Empire. And so without him, what we saw is that remnants basically broke out. Rebellion spread even faster, and then Imperial officers all headed for the doors. And they all took their own Star Destroyers and their own fleets, and they took their toys and went to go play by themselves. There was no sense of unity or shared purpose amongst the actual Imperial hierarchy. So I think there you pretty much have the death blow, is that they have no real structure for power change.
He's absolutely correct. The Empire was set up as an autocracy, and basically when all the higher-ups in the government, like he said, failed, when they died on the Death Star, there was nothing, and kind of what Steven was hinting at about how the remaining admirals took their toys and left, that was kind of explored in a novel called Star Wars Aftermath, which takes place before Episode 7, and that's kind of what happened, and that's where the First Order came from.
You know, I'll bring in Colleen at this point, because I know that you have some interesting thoughts on how the First Order relates to all this. If you want to go ahead and introduce some of those now, would be probably a good time.
I think as far as the Empire, the Galactic Empire, as it was called, falling at that particular time, I think what happened with the Rebellion is that they were able to take advantage of or widen the cracks that already existed in the system, which is, what enabled them to be so successful there with destroying the second Death Star and, you know, getting rid of Palpatine and Vader and all the other fun people. But I kind of argued that the question you ask about was the Galactic Empire doomed to fail, I think it really just also hinges on what you mean by failure. At the end of Return of the Jedi, the Galactic Empire was completely crippled. They weren't destroyed yet. Anyway, they were still fighting the Rebellion. You know, the Rebellion was still fighting the remnants of the Empire. The Battle of Jakku took place about, 1 year after the events of Return of the Jedi?
I believe
Yeah, so then what was left of the Empire, you know, in the middle of that battle, they signed the Galactic Concordance, which basically said, okay, we're going to go take our toys and go back to the unknown regions of the galaxy now. But my argument is that because while they were out there on the unknown regions doing whatever it was they were doing, they were basically just building up their navy, building up the military. They came back, they were reorganized, and they came back as the First Order. So my argument is simply is that the Empire itself never really went away. It just reorganized and renamed itself as the First Order. So, and then when the First Order came back, they've got this giant death planet, like literally death planet, and they use it to destroy the Republic in a single shot. I mean, they're gone. I mean, so they're not out of the running. I view them as saying they've always been around. They may not have been the main power in the galaxy for the last, 30-ish years or something? Mm-hmm.
It's about 30 years.
About 30 years? Okay, sweet. But they never disappeared. They always just kind of hung in the shadows. And somebody gave them a ton of money, by the way, to be able to build Starkiller Base. Like, there are a lot of people who support the Empire and the Empire's ideals. And their military presence, the fact that they have this giant death planet, they destroy the Republic twice. By the way, the Empire destroyed the old Republic. They've destroyed the new Republic. They're still around. They're still there. They still exist. And if their purpose in their existence was to get rid of the Republic, I'd say they succeeded.
Well, I think the only thing I'd like to add to that is I'm not entirely sure that it is right to classify the First Order as being the Empire. I mean, what you're really talking about is like the kids of Imperial officers who are trying to revive this general idea of the autocracy and of order. What we see in, and you mentioned Lost Stars, I believe was the book you're referencing with the Battle of Jakku, which was a really awesome book. And in the Aftermath series by Chuck Wendig, the way, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't even think that they've gotten an official surrender from Mas Amida, who is chairing the Empire at this point on Coruscant by the end of the second Aftermath book. So the Empire is still chugging along, but it basically is headed towards a surrender, which I think we're going to be getting. So if they formally surrender and they are no longer a thing, I don't even know if it's accurate to say that the First Order is the Empire. It's really just a commitment to its ideals based off rogue generals. But, I mean, obviously we're dealing with the same sort of players, the same players who are in the Empire, help build, put this thing together. And what you were mentioning about a lot of affinity towards the Empire is alive and well in the New Republic Senate. There are a huge amount of people in the centrist party who are incredibly interested in trying to restore the values of the Empire. So its ideas live on, but I think it as a government is definitely toasted post-Battle of Jakku.
Yeah, Matt, I want to bring you in here because I think that what Steven's hitting on is that the Empire might be desirable for some people because it is representative of order and stability, with the exception of, you know, the whole rebellion. You know, what's your take on the First Order taking up the mantle of the Empire, so to speak?
It really reminds me of, and I really, really hate to bring them into this because I can already hear people screaming Godwin's Law, but it reminds me of what the NDSAP did in the 1930s in Germany, trying to recapture the glory of the Second Reich, which was, of course, under Kaiser Wilhelm during World War I. And a lot of that appeal was what drew people towards the Nazi Party politically, was they were trying to recapture that image. And while they were, to an extent, kind of a pale copy that then mutated into its own monstrous, horrible thing, that is really the feel I get from it. I see a lot of similarities there.
I see that. Is there any, now I ask you this because you're a specialist in Imperial Japan. Are there any parallels there as well with the Japanese trying to recapture the classic Shogun period in the 40s?
I would say with the not so much really from the Imperial House, and as you know, Josh, I've extensively studied the career of Emperor Hirohito.
Yes.
I would really say it's less the Imperial House and more Tojo and the army of Japan trying to recapture lost imperial glory of the, to an extent, imagined great empires of the past. Because really every time a group, especially if they're extreme in one direction or another, when they're hearkening back to these grand old times, these great times past, which we must recapture and get back to, generally a large extent of it is a false aura placed upon it in retrospect.
Are you saying they're trying to make Japan great again?
I didn't want to go there.
Oh, but it's a rich, I mean, it is a rich topic. I mean, the idea that really what the First Order, I mean, I made this this into a meme at one point on Twitter, was just putting, you know, the make the Empire Great Again hat onto General Hux giving a speech. And it's not so much a knock on Trump as it's a introduction of nostalgia politics into the way that these movements mm-hmm. form. There is always a looking backwards for a time of greatness, a time of former glory. And if you are General Hux, who, you know, your dad was a part of the grand old proud empire, and a lot of these people who are probably in the higher ups are as well, I mean, that is what they're trying to recapture. And so detaching, you know, the Trump campaign, which was really brilliant logo, from this idea that's a little bit more dark, you know, we always look back, and these empires that you just mentioned, even, you know, down to the Second Reich, the Third Reich, they're always trying to restore something that was previously great, and that's what the centrists and what the First Order are trying to do.
I will point a parallel here, though. I think you could also say the same thing or something similar happens with Luke and a lot of the rebellion because they're trying to restore the Republic. So from their point of view, from an outsider looking in, like the Yusong Vong, maybe, rather outsiders looking in, there's not much of a difference, or it's 2 degrees of separation, but there's not really anything distinguishing them. Now, obviously, we know there's a difference between the Republic and the Empire empirically, but it's the same nostalgia politics of trying to restore what was once lost. Colleen, you don't agree?
Well, actually, I'm looking. If you look at it from a larger picture, beyond just, I mean, nostalgia for, you know, for a lost past. I mean, you look at the history of the galaxy, starting with the prequels, all the way up to where we are, you know, with Episode 7. What do we have? I mean, it's literally been Star Wars. You have the Clone Wars, and then you have the fall of the Old Republic, the rise of the Empire, then the emergence of the Rebellion, the fall of the Empire, and then the you know, battles between what was left of the Empire and the Rebellion and the forming of the New Republic, which just, by the way, just got blown to hell. So you're seeing what I'm seeing is a very long, you know, like this is like what, 60 years, you know, at least of a struggle over the best form of government, you know, for the galaxy. So I think that the people, a lot of the people who, for example, in these new movies, in The Force Awakens, who still support the Empire, they're not evil. You know, I mean, a lot of them, I mean, yeah, okay, a lot of them are higher-ups are probably the douchebags. Like, you have to be a supreme douchebag to, like, blow up an entire star system because you disagree with their former government. I mean, that, duh. But, you know, your average stormtrooper is not a jerk. I mean, you know, Finn's not a jerk, right? You know, but he was brought up by the First Order. He was brought up on, you know, one of their Star Destroyer things. But I think what they're thinking about is, if you think about in the larger history of the galaxy, the Old Republic failed. Yes, Palpatine was manipulating things that he could rise to power, but it failed because they were so ineffective. They were bogged down in bureaucracy. They could not make any decisions. They were focused too much on the war, and they weren't able to support, you know, their own people. And so they failed. When the Empire rose, yes, they, again, you know, ruled with an iron fist. But if you think about it, they ended the Clone Wars. They restored trade between the planets, created a new economic system. They even ended human slavery, which is something the Old Republic could not even do. Granted, they still had slavery, but they did end human slavery, and they were at least able to create a temporary peace and form a stability. And so then that all went to hell, you know, when during the Galactic Civil War with the Rebellion. So I can see, and they've basically been fighting with each other since. It really hasn't, the New Republic really hasn't been around a lot. For very long. So I can see that people living throughout this time period going, you know what, this sucks. I want to go back to the Empire because, you know, at least I wasn't always worried about getting caught in the crosshairs of some random battle. At least things made sense.
Colleen is actually moving us in the direction of something I was hoping we'd be able to talk about tonight.
Oh, and God. I apologize in advance, Internet.
So the main question is, was the Empire doomed to fail, regardless of the events of the film? And that enormous burgeoning bureaucracy that's constantly focused on wars and combat is really something I wanted to discuss, because I firmly believe that even without the Rebellion, the Empire would have collapsed on itself, because it wouldn't have been able to sustain itself financially.
I agree with Matt.
Because empires build and they grow and they sustain themselves by taxing and taking from and stripping apart the things that they expand into. And the Empire was running out of places to expand and tear apart.
You could actually make their job harder by building the Death Star, because then they're going to blow up planets. They'd have even less to expand.
Right. And the thing is, you know, in our world, superpowers such as ourselves in the U.S., we spend money we don't have by borrowing it on credit from other similarly sized governments. The Galactic Empire doesn't really have an analog of their own size. And, you know, if they just start saying, oh, we're just going to start, you know, making more credits and putting them into circulation, we're going to get runaway hyperinflation. And we saw how well that worked out in various parts of Africa in the 90s. So you get to the point where it's going to collapse on itself because the Empire had 25,000 Star Destroyers in the Imperial class at one point. And one Star Destroyer costed, I believe it was supposed to be approximately the same amount as the economic output of like three or four star systems for an entire year to make one of those. And they've got 25,000 of them? And that's before you bring the Death Stars into the mix?
Steven, from the Beltway Banthas, knows politics. DC knows budgets. And what we're really talking about here is a question of resource allocation and budgets. And in the city where budgets are the end-all, be-all of life, I'm sure that, Steven, you have some interesting thoughts on this question.
Well, first of all, we don't pass budgets here. Let's be very clear. We just kick them down the road, and then we just sort of assume that they're just going to take place anyways. I'll speak to the budget question here and just kind of back up one step before I do that. I mean, but in general, I do think it was doomed to fail. Empires thrive on circumstances that allow them to outlive their actual means, and you sort of honed in on that when you're talking about taxation. I mean, the empire relies on subjugation of people. They have to subdue and they have to exploit lesser peoples all across the galaxy to fund their expansion and fund all of their activities for security. And really, at the end of the day, the only thing that the empire is selling to people is the idea of security in a post-Clone Wars world. That was the reason that they were brought into existence in the first place, was because people were scared. Well, at a certain point, people aren't scared anymore. You know, the war is over, and now they're just looking at the stormtroopers on their block, and they're just scared of them. And so you have the problem of taxation and internal order always pushing up against each other. Because when you have one group of people, a planet in this case, you know, say like Lothal, you need taxes and you need order and you need consent for both. And if you don't have the consent of the governed for taxation or for order, you're going to have rebellion. And that is essentially what you see happening over and over and over again across the galaxy. And when you crack down on people and you get rid of people and then you maybe start working them to death, like Ransom Castierfo's family was in the Bloodline novel, for the production of Imperial supplies, you only increase dissatisfaction and anger, and you also decrease your tax pool and you're killing off your people. But going to the economy and sort of budgets around the Death Star, I mean, it's a ridiculously huge project, but we have learned one thing about its production that we didn't know. Now, first of all, have y'all ever heard of the Cost of the Death Star white paper by Zachary Feinstein, the Empire's poison pill?
Oh my God, no, but I'm about to read.
Okay, so this was an actual economic essay written by Professor Zachary Feinstein of Washington University. It's called The Emperor's Poison Pill, and it was written as an actual political science narrative, and this came out around The Force Awakens, got a lot of hype and a lot of mainstream news outlets about the cost of the Death Star project and how big it actually was. And what this guy did was he basically compared the cost of American aircraft carriers as relatively equal to parts of the Death Star. He thought this was a good comparison because the ships require about the same amount of resources as steel in terms of cost, comparing the United States and the Empire. And so if you understand the price of steel in the Star Wars universe, it's kind of a good way to measure the worth of the Death Star. But with all that said and done, he basically came to the conclusion that the first Death Star would cost 193 quintillion dollars, and the second would cost 419 quintillion dollars. Now, the fascinating thing that I liked about this is the cronyism angle. We've talked about nationalized banks and the empire and nationalized companies. Basically, the emperor brought in organizations like the banking plan, the techno union, and all of these different manufacturing and banking guilds, and basically nationalize them into the empire. These are not independent entities anymore. And so when you're roping in these groups to fund projects really against will, it's the equivalent of pumping out fake money like we already do here in the United States, when we don't actually have any real capital to back up all the paper that we're putting out there. So when you're forcing these people to fund a Death Star project, and then that Death Star project is destroyed by a rebellion, you have economic collapse, because that is your only thing that is an actual physical asset to back up the wealth of your nation and of your banks, or in this case, of your empire. So it's
collateral. Great shot, Luke.
So I am. I'm just picturing the Empire's stockbroker just tisking and saying, "I'm sorry, Lord Vader, but you didn't properly diversify your portfolio."
The Empire doesn't have any meaningful products. They don't do anything. All they do is take, take, take. And just as an economic model of, again, we're talking about consent of the governed, and I'm a free markets guy, like, that's, you can't go very far with that model. It really is a recipe for failure.
It is a resource issue, and you have to wonder if the poison pill thesis is correct, and there's no reason to discount the equivalency of aircraft carriers and Star Wars steel.
Because why the hell not?
Then you have to wonder, was there any upside at all to building the Death Star aside from, you know, making Grand Moff Tarkin a very happy man?
Well, he was a happy man for, like, all of 3 minutes.
The Death Star did completely eliminate unemployment on Alderaan.
Yes.
Oh.
I was actually going to say that tonight, but good on you.
A Trudeau eulogy. No, I mean, that's really, like, a great point about the Death Star, though. I mean, this is a project that did, for all intents and purposes, achieve its goal, but for a very limited amount of time. And the real like wrench in this whole situation is Luke and the Force. I mean, Luke and the Force was the thing that you could not really predict for. And I think without that factor, you have a very different outcome, because, you know, again, the laws of Force mean that the Death Star can govern the galaxy. Tarkin was not wrong when he said that people will fall in line based out of fear. Again, like, the Empire is immensely militarily powerful. They can fight and they can kill off opposition. It's just that the Rebellion was able to get these very, very specific targeted wins that were huge in scope. And kind of going back again to the cost of the Death Star, one thing that we didn't fully know about the cost was that it was largely built by Geonosians. Back then, we didn't really know that. Now that's something that we are aware of.
In the movies.
They did hint at it, but we didn't know that Geonosian laborers are actually going to be roped in at no cost. They're not slave laborers, but they are doing it for free.
And then construction...
So basically, they are Imperial interns.
Yep. They are interns. They are interns for Poggle the Lesser.
And construction had began before the end of the Clone Wars.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Per the new book.
He's a very forward-thinking man.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do.
All of them are trained in retrieving coffee.
I wonder at what point did that creature get into the trash compactor, because that's the odd thing.
That was a prank.
I don't typically do...
The equivalent of somebody flushing their goldfish down the toilet and then...
You know, Ed, I want to ask you, Ed, because Stephen mentioned the rule of Force, and I'm wondering, yes, the Death Star is incredibly frightening, but I would be just as scared if, let's just say, 50 of those 50,000 Star Destroyers came up to my planet and started firing at point-blank range. I'd be scared just as much. So do you think that they could have still achieved the fear element without going to the Death Star level? What do you think, Ed?
Well, first of all, I don't typically do this, but I have a hashtag. Hashtag, Luke created the Great Galactic Depression.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Okay, but without the Death Star, yes, I believe they could, through various things. In the old canon, which is considered legends now, there was various instances of... again, slavery, which we've touched on, intimidation, fear, used without the Death Star whatsoever, rampant xenophobia. Another thing that I... and yeah, the Star Destroyers are massive. I think we talked about this in when we had our ship discussion a few weeks ago. But without the Death Star, they could do it. Just with the Death Star, it's a very, very, very imposing thing. And it's kind of hard to question the ability to destroy an entire planet in a split second.
Yeah, you know, that actually reminds me of something I was thinking. I was actually ranting to Josh about this via text the other day, about how the First Order in Episode 7 could have very easily have just been like, game over, done, bitches, because after they blew up the Republic, and actually I have a whole nother rant involving they should have actually taken out the Resistance first, and then taken out the Republic, because the Resistance were the only ones that actually had the capabilities to do what they did, which is, you know, blow up their giant death planet. But anyway... because the New Republic doesn't have an army. They made a conscious decision not to actually to actually demilitarize, you know, because they wouldn't be threatening. And look what happened. They got blown up. But anyway, so whether or not the Starkiller base worked, because quite frankly, maybe they missed. You never know. The First Order should have already been ready to mobilize and then appear out of hyperspace and, like, just surround all of, like, the really key planets that were part of the Republic and, like, force them to capitulate. And then, bam, whether or not, you know, the Starkiller base worked, they would have won, hands down. Galaxy is mine.
Yeah, so I'm going to introduce a parallel here, and I want to get, you know, especially Colleen and Matt, your historical opinions. I'm thinking, and I hadn't thought of this before, but is it possible to say that the Star Destroyers are the equivalent of the firebombs in Japan, but the Death Star is the atomic bomb? That one big blow that can completely demoralize the other side and end it, and that's the psychology behind it.
I don't know, if you're looking at the firebombs in Japan actually killed more people than...
But so did the Star Destroyer. If you look at their 50,000 across the entire empire.
Well, yeah, but they weren't destroying planets with the Star Destroyers. In fact, I'm not actually quite sure what they did with the Star Destroyers other than to hang out near planets and just look intimidating.
That's true.
Well, the thing is, I think I agree with Josh on this. And the reasoning for that being, yeah, the Death Star is the big, scary... piss your pants and surrender when you know it's coming thing. But the actual tools of conquest were the Star Destroyers. The ones that were actually going out and taking star systems were the Star Destroyers.
Yes.
The Death Star went out, and it made a point. And the goal of the Death Star is to tell systems, when the Star Destroyer comes, you surrender, or the Death Star's following it.
Mm.
It's the ultimate tool of psyops.
Right.
Yeah.
They come in, and using your analogy, they come in with the firebombing, and they're like, hey, we're doing damage, and we're attacking, and you need to surrender, because if you don't, we're going to get really bored with the firebombing, and we're dropping the nuke.
That is true. The Star Destroyers did have the ability to essentially attack a planet from space, like, you know, bomb a planet from space with their, like, lasers and stuff.
Well, an Imperial-class Star Destroyer had a crew of 37,000.
No,
That's not a small craft.
I would get recruited by the Empire, be sent to one of their ships, and you would never see me again. I would spend my entire military career just trying to find my way back to my damn room.
Probably. The U.S. Navy's aircraft carriers use a crew of 5,500 people, and they're actually referred to as the floating cities, because they have a large enough population that were they to go somewhere uninhabited in the States, they would have enough people to actually incorporate as a city.
Wow.
You know, I just, doing the math for all the Star Destroyers, and I mean, and those are just, you said, how many were there?
50,000.
There were 37,000 crew, and there were 25,000 ships, and that's just in the Imperial class.
Just in the Imperial class.
That's not even counting the Victory class or the Super Star Destroyer.
What's the capacity on a Super Star Destroyer?
Oh my god, It's eight. Well, a regular Star Destroyer is a mile long, and a Super Star Destroyer is 8 miles long. A Super Star Destroyer is literally eight times the size. It is 19,000 meters in length.
I have the results here. Oh my god. Okay. To fully man 25,000 Star Destroyers at 37,000 soldiers per ship requires conscripting, drumroll please, 925 billion people.
And that's just the regular Star Destroyers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Executor class, which is the Super Star Destroyers, those have a crew of 280,000.
And how many were there in the fleet?
The only one we ever actually saw was, I believe, the Executor.
And so that was in what, Return of the Jedi?
We're easily into the trillions. We're going to be easily into the trillions at this point.
And you know, on screen, and we're going to have to base that part of it just on the screen, they never showed anything but flat-out humans, androids, manning the Empire.
Right. It was a human empire.
And, well, in the novels, they have female crew members, but you never really saw any within the films.
Well, you have Captain Phasma, and that's the First Order.
So. Well, yeah, I'm talking about just the Empire.
Yeah.
And again, Captain Phasma is useless, completely, completely useless. We've got into this discussion more than once.
Yeah, we have.
I mean, this brings me back to my question, though, about, so the First Order obviously has got some very powerful, very wealthy backers if they were able to make the Starkiller base, which was a hell of a lot bigger than any of those, you know, Death Stars. I mean...
Yeah, the Death Stars were the size of a small moon, and Starkiller Base was a literal planet. Okay. It was literally a terraformed planet.
This is off subject a little bit, but I don't know if it's just from trying to recapture the feel of the original trilogy, or lazy writing, or, geez, I don't have a good idea. Why did they fall back on... It's essentially another Death Star, albeit a bigger one... Why, if it failed twice, moreover, why, if it failed once, would you sink the money into it? And this is part of the reason that...
I think I have an answer.
The Empire failed, because... And Stephen knows, because he's read Catalyst as well, just the research and the materials and money, and we discussed the money that went into the construction of one Death Star was ridiculous.
I think, though, if you think about it, how long exactly it took, at least 19 years or whatever to build the first Death Star. What if the Starkiller base was actually started by the Empire? We just didn't know about it.
It could have been Snoke, but we don't know. I mean, that'll be later. I'm sure it'll get discussed somewhere.
Yeah, Matt and then Steven.
So the argument I make is, well, it's two parts. First of all, for the... Why they did it from a writing perspective, I think, was to try and recapture the feel, that feel of the awe of this thing is freaking gigantic and it's going to kill us all and murder us dead feel. So I think it was trying to recapture, and I think that may have been a bit misguided. But for story purposes, like within the story, I would argue that the reason they did it a third time was because obsession does not listen to reason.
You know,
and the First Order was obsessed with recapturing the glory of the Empire, and what's the biggest symbol of the Empire you can think of? The Death Star.
This is just from a film goer's point of view, and somebody that absolutely loves Star Wars. Usually, some of my favorite scenes within the movies, and that's part of the reason why the prequels suck so much, is the battles, like the space battles. They're so, you know, the first Death Star battle, and then even the second Death Star battle, and then, you know, just the ship-to-ship combat is the best, to me, in the series, besides, like, the lightsaber duels. But then, for whatever reason, the lazy writing, the familiarity of the original trilogy, whatever they were going for, that was the most... It was the least engaging part of that film for me, and usually I'm all for it. Oh man, there's X-Wings and there's TIE Fighters and they're trying to destroy it. But I was watching the movie, and I've seen it two or three times now, I'm just wasn't that invested in the scene. Yeah.
So, Steven, what's your rationale for why they would go back and dip their toes in the water a third time?
I'm usually really nice about things when it comes to story, but I have a really hard time with the Starkiller base and being nice about the intentions. I think it was lazy, and it was to recapture a feel for fans who felt out of Star Wars for about the past 10 years, and they were trying to bring them back in, and it really was in the worst possible way.
And I will bring in that other franchise for a second. We know Abrams wrote this, and he also helmed the Star Trek reboot. He did the same bloody thing with the Star Trek Part II when he brought back Khan, and he recycled the Khan storyline almost the same way, with some lines just being word for word, to the point where, I mean, as a real Trekkie, I was hoping for Cumberbatch to be anybody but Khan. It's anybody, a new character, Q even, would be awesome for Benedict Cumberbatch, but no, they went with the Khan storyline in almost the same way. And he used the trope of introducing a ship that was five times bigger than any other ship when he had the new Federation ship that had been built in secret that was so big. And how did they defeat it? With a flaw in its design.
Was that the USS Vengeance in that movie? I'm trying to remember. Was that the name of the...
I think it was, yeah.
That would be the USS Gotcha Sucker.
I like your term better.
I thought it was the USS Death Star.
And I will bring in two other quick trivia points on when you said that the ship would be a city, a floating city. The third biggest city in Tennessee when they're playing is a Tennessee football game because there's 106,000 people there. That's an interesting trivia fact. Also, when you're talking about finding your way back to your office on the Star Destroyer, Colleen, the Star Trek Next Generation writers actually made a map of the Enterprise D. They put in engineering for that purpose, and they actually refer to the map when they're writing episodes, so they make sure they know how to get people from point A to point B, and it makes sense. However, they failed to put bathrooms on the schematics, so it is the eternal mystery of TNG as to where people went to the bathroom on a galaxy-class starship.
They've evolved past those bodily functions.
Well, some people have actually speculated that they used a transporter to take care of it.
Guys, I don't think about where Darth Vader does his business. I don't want to care about where to go.
I don't want to know how Spock evacuates his bowels, okay?
I'm just saying, it's an interesting thing. Like they made this incredibly detailed map, and of course us nerds look at it and we're like, it's missing the most obvious thing.
Well, I'm sorry, Leonard Nimoy does not poop. He has ascended above that.
Guys, I don't understand, quite honestly, what the complaints are all about. I mean, obviously, the Death Star and Starkiller base are totally different. One is a Death Star. It's the size of a moon. The other is the size of a planet. One has a thermal exhaust port. One has a thermal oscillator. Totally different.
Yeah, what offends me about Starkiller base is how much work they're doing to build up the importance, the intricacy, and the toughness of building the Death Star. You know, it's and you were close. It's a 22-year project to get that first one up. And between Catalyst and Rogue One and some of the groundwork they've laid in Clone Wars and the prequels, I mean, the romanticism of building the Death Star is just massive. And then for them to just come out with a product that is 5-10 times bigger than that and not explain how, what, who, when, where, why, what it cost, anything, and just expect us to take it when the Death Star is now such an intricate project, it's just really, really bad.
Actually probably is just as old as the original Death Star. I mean, it can't have just popped up within 30 years.
It could be. I think that's very possible.
Well, let's factor something else in here. We've already established the length of time it took to create the first Death Star. You can allow some speeding up of the process from having done it previously, but I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that the second Death Star was that far along by Return of the Jedi had they not started it before completion of the first one.
No, I agree, but they just didn't know about it. They had to have been doing this simultaneously. It's like in the movie Contact. Remember when they build like the one giant transporter thing and then it falls to pieces because it gets blown up, but then you find out Japan was making it all in secret? Yeah. We're going on the same path and we're starting to you know, realize or at least agree that Starkiller Base is probably something that was created by the Empire and, you know, and the First Order used it. I'm looking at the Starkiller Base as probably is like a weapon of, like, I guess, last resort. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I guess you can only really use once. And they did it, and they used it very effectively. I mean, they did destroy the New Republic with it.
Yeah, so they destroyed the New Republic, and I'm wondering here, you know, to circle us back a little bit to the main question, because I think there's an entire B&Q down the line as to the military strategies of the Empire and the First Order. But to circle back, you know, we've established here that they have this obsession with mega projects that aren't necessarily positive for the economy. So we've talked about so far, Stephen brought up the succession problem that the Empire was the Emperor. We've brought up the issue of economics with resource allocation, taxation, phony economy, infrastructure problems, manpower issues. So these are all knocks against the Empire, but Colleen, you of course brought up the earlier argument that the Empire truly didn't fail, at least not completely, and the First Order is a, if not the Empire, it is certainly a reimagining of it by its ideological successors. I don't know if any of us has taken the position that the Empire wasn't going to fail if it weren't for the rebellion. I think we've mentioned a little bit with Luke and the Force as the, you know, it's like an insurance, the act of God. In this case, it's the act of Force, or the act of Lucas, if you want to make Lucas the God, which he thinks he is anyway.
True.
But we have to think about that for a minute, because that is the counter here, is that with all these flaws, a lot of political systems have flaws in them, horrible flaws, but somehow find a way to hang on. And you have to wonder if the rebellion goes the other way. We talked about what would have happened if they had been successful in turning Luke dark. Or we talked about Obi-Wan, but thinking about if they had turned Luke dark, you know, maybe things go differently and maybe the Empire finds a way. I'm not sure. I'm just trying to propose the other side so that any listeners who are of that persuasion don't feel that they've been left out here. Stephen, I'll go to you. Do you think there's any validity to thinking that the Empire would have subsisted for an indefinite amount of time had it not been for the action specifically taken by the Rebel Alliance?
Well, sure. I was able to convince myself of this the other day when trying to think about it the other way, and I think we've identified Luke and the Force as the spoiler here, so kind of pushing that out of my mind a little bit, I mean, if China is an example of an autocratic state that can succeed, the difference is that China, like we mentioned earlier, produces products for the world. What does the Empire produce? Well, it produces nothing except subjugation and pain. They just labor people without their consent, and they offer no real return. You know, when the fog of war clears after 10 to 15 years and security is no longer up in front and center, what you have to be offering is opportunity and prosperity. Now, there's an important distinction here to be made between the real world empires and the Empire. Here on Earth, you might have the Islamic Empire, Roman Empire, the Prussian Empire, and I don't know, maybe Mongolians or something, all active and growing at the same time. And these forces are going to collide and bump up against each other. And they all have the possibility, or there is always the possibility that one will benefit, maybe two, and then the others will fail and fall apart as a result of the others' influence and control over trade and territory. And because the empires are not flexible and nimble when things come to change, the Empire, I think you could make the argument that they're not bumping up against anybody. They're not in competition with any other large force. Now that the Yun Sung Vong are no longer a threat to them in terms of the canon, they're out of the canon universe, we know that there's not this other thing looming out there that could take them out. So if they control the greater galaxy and the majority of the territory, you can't overthrow them. They have the army, they have the guns, they have the tools. They also just have the control of the economic levers of the galaxy, so they can make this thing grind on forever. You don't have to have happy people to have people be subject to you because they're afraid. And so I think the Death Star, had it lasted, it would have achieved the goal that the Emperor had set out, which was total submission. I think the only cog in that wheel, or not the cog in that wheel, the other wrench in that could be if actual Imperials, stormtroopers and officers become disillusioned with the mission and what they're accomplishing because they wanted to make people happy, but they're actually just stepping on everybody's throats. But that's my long-winded case to say that this thing could last because brutality is a means to govern. It's just not the right one, and it's not very very long-sighted.
Yeah, and I do want to point out for totality's sake, when I say that Luke was the cog or the wrench, monkey wrench in the machine, it's also possible that Leia could have been the monkey wrench in the machine. Because, you know, she was the other hope, as Yoda and Obi-Wan so put it, which, of course...
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's also possible. But as it is, we don't know. But I think you're right, that without those cogs in the wheel, who knows? Ed, I think you make a good point about, you know, you told me earlier that with the Empire, you think that the government and the military are the same thing. That there's no... It's not a, you know, separation of powers in the Empire. It is what it is.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, if we want to look at it as a complete picture, as outside observers that we are, the Empire was created through war. Palpatine was orchestrating this with... He is a master tactician in science fantasy, I swear to God. But he orchestrated all of the stuff. He orchestrated the Clone Wars and then the fall of the Republics. He was playing both sides of the war. And then it was born of war. And then the mentality of the officers and the leaders of the Empire at that point, as we've stated, is to rule through fear and intimidation. So to me, that makes it synonymous with the government, with the military, and they were essentially one big organism.
Yeah, and I think, Colleen, I think you wanted to maybe chime in on this as well.
I was just going to say, it's when you rise to power using force the way that Palpatine did, it is very difficult to then come down from that because he used, it's like with the Tarkin Doctrine, you know, I mean, it got to the point where that was the only way it was like that he could maintain control was through the use of force. I know Palpatine was probably totally cool with that because he's a douchebag. But the reality is, I mean, if you think about it, you're like, okay, hey, I wanna rule the world or whatever. And then you have your little army and you're like, yay. Whether it's, you know, normal people or an actual, like, you know, military force, disciplined force. And then you rule the world. Well, then crap. Now what? I mean, maybe you have to, you know, maintain order, stability somehow. And it's like digging a never-ending hole. You might want to back out, you like back away from using force, but you can never get rid of it completely. And Palpatine's solution and the Empire's solution was to just keep tightening that fist. It's like what Leia said, you know, the more you tighten your fist, the more star systems will slip through your fingers. It comes to a head at some point. Either the people are going to come up and rebel, you know, or the military itself might end up, you know, rebelling. Something's got to give. You know, you have those tensions. It's incredibly difficult to govern that way.
Yeah, and Matt, as an expert in military affairs, do you think that it is plausible to think that eventually, if there's no rebellion down the road, eventually some of the stormtroopers start saying, you know what, this mission isn't what we thought it was, and they get some leaders involved, and you get a civil war.
Well, my thinking is that looking at empires in general, and especially ones that are so heavily focused on military and expansion, like the Galactic Empire, that they're pretty much every empire is going to contract. It expands. After it expands, it's going to contract. And the question is going to be how it's going to do it. And there are some that'll expand to their greatest point, and then they'll shrink back. And there will be some remnant of it that'll still be left and stable much later, similar to the United Kingdom. The sun never sets on the British Empire was the big saying for a very long time. They controlled a huge portion of the world, and they slowly contracted by letting territories go or the occasional rebellion. But ones that expand so violently and govern through fear, you have and inevitability of rebellion. So either the citizenry is going to rebellion and create something like the Rebel Alliance, or it is going to get to the point where it expands and burgeons so much and loses sight of its purpose and loses its message along the way, that you are going to have a militarily led coup. And you're looking at Grand Moffs coming after the Emperor.
Yeah, so...
At which point he would then just electrocute them all to death.
Yeah, I favor that outcome as being pretty possible. I think the Grand Moffs and breaking them and giving the amount of power that they actually have as regional governors, I think that is a very bad outcome for the Emperor and Coruscant, having people like Grand Moff Tarkin control the entire Outer Rim. There's just no good way for that to end.
So I know that this discussion could go on indefinitely, and it probably will, but I think it's time for us to wrap up our episode. So I'm going to go around our panel, and I want you to give me a one-sentence answer on, was the Empire doomed to fail? Yes, no, or the question is invalid, and why? I know, and... So this is your final answer on the question, at least for now. I'll start with Matt.
Yes, the Empire was doomed to fail, and it was doomed to fail specifically because any empire ruled by fear always collapses on itself.
Ed?
I agree with Matt. Yes, it was doomed to fail, not only because of the rule by fear, but the overzealous nature and just the corruption of worlds and consumption of funds and materials and ore and all that stuff.
Colleen?
No, the Empire did not fail. It still lives as the First Order. Long live the Galactic Empire.
And Steven?
Doomed to fail. You cannot sustain yourself without free people and free markets.
And I think it was doomed to fail because of its misallocation of resources. But that is our answer. So hooray to the panel. I want to thank all of our regulars, Colleen and Ed and Matt. Thank you. And Steven, thank you so much. I hope you had a good time today on B&Q.
Oh, such a blast. Thanks a lot for having me on. We don't normally get to go this long on our show. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
And we have one more piece of business. Matt.
That's right.
You have to kill off the abomination of the Star Wars universe.
That's right, Josh. Because, you see, we've been talking about the First Order today, but every day the final order of business is killing Jar Jar Binks. And today, Jar Jar Binks was horrifically killed. In fact, you could say he was vaporized when he was caught in the path of explosive Imperial hyperinflation.
Very punny.
Oh man,
that's what I do.
His innards created the area under the bell curve.
Oh my god.
You ever heard the story of C-3PO's red arm?
No, but I would like to.
Well, C-3PO actually got that red arm by performing Kali Ma on Jar Jar.
C-3PO is the hero we both needed and deserved.
Kalima!
Kalima!
I knew there was a reason I loved that beautiful gold bastard.
Does that make R2 the droid version of Short Round?
Yes!
Steven, I want to thank you again. And for Colleen, Matt, and Ed, this is Josh saying we will see you again. Same B&Q time, same B&Q channel. Good day.